The North Carolina Reading Service now brings you your Indie Week from December the 1st, 2020. I'm John Federson, reading Indie Week for our blind and print-impaired audience. Welcome. And from our vast sound stage this week, our musicians, who are all from the 5th Field Flank Formation of the Fife and Fiddle Artillery, follow their formidable field formations just for us. And they march off, and we'll hear from them again at the end of the broadcast. And our first story from Michael Taffy, Old Guard. Chapel Hill retirees stage ongoing Black Lives Matter demonstration. Stan Coleman sits alone in a lawn chair at the busy intersection of Raleigh Road and the Meadow Mount Lane in East Chapel Hill. Every afternoon since June, he's set up a large sign with Black Lives Matter painted on a white background. Then he sits behind it as traffic passes by on the six-lane highway. "We could not just sit around and not do anything," Coleman says. He takes the afternoon shift while fellow demonstrators David DeMarini and Jay Greenberg take the mornings. He says, "We're all enfeebled old white guys and we're retired, but I think we're successful if people just feel good from this stoplight to the next one." Coleman and Greenberg's friend Eric Teagarden discussed the idea for the demonstration in June after the killing of George Floyd. They began the Monday after Father's Day. DeMarini, an adjunct professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Gillings School of Global Public Health, joined soon after. While the protest is centered on the Black Lives Movement, it is carried out by a group of white men in their 60s and 70s. Coleman says white men bear the responsibility of keeping racial justice in the conversation because white men caused the injustice. He says that while he recognizes that the conversation around the Black Lives Matter movement has decreased since the summer, it's important to not let the issue fall by the wayside. The men plan to put the demonstration on hold during the winter months and return when the cold breaks. He said, "We're going to stop at the end of December, and we're going to figure out what to do in between and when to restart after that in the spring." The morning after Election Day, DeMarini and Greenberg had their chairs set up on the same corner with the same painted sign. Greenberg, 73, says he's been involved in protests and social movements since the 1960s, beginning with the movement against the war in Vietnam. For him, the small demonstration was appealing because it would allow him to be involved without exposing himself to COVID-19. Greenberg says he was active during the civil rights movement. He sympathizes with people frustrated with the often slow pace of social change, but says it's more important than ever to raise awareness now. "Have you ever been to the Grand Canyon?" he asks. "That stone wasn't cut overnight. This isn't going to happen overnight, so we've got to keep going. It's a marathon." DeMarini says his last major involvement in a protest movement was as a student at Illinois State University, marching in opposition to the Vietnam War. He says he witnessed the same sentiments from people during the 60s anti-war movement as he did during the Trump presidency, folks wanting to move out of the country rather than live in an unfavorable political climate. But he emphasized the importance of making a personal effort. "Back in the 60s and 70s, it was America, love it or leave it," he says. That was the chant from people who thought everything was just hunky-dory. And so some people chose to leave. But most people chose to take a stand and try to change things. They ran for elected office and started various social movements. That morning, on the side of the highway, passers-by on the sidewalk wave and voice their support. Bill Roper, former interim president of the UNC system, walks by with his dog. "Hang in there," he says. Both DeMarini and Greenberg say the goal of their demonstration has been to keep the Black Lives Matter movement visible in Chapel Hill, even when election coverage and other news cycles have taken some eyes off of it. Based on the small but vocal group of objectors they've encountered, even in progressive areas like Chapel Hill, there's plenty of work to be done, they say. Greenberg says going dormant until the next flare-up is not an answer. It's not as exciting, but it's effective. Get involved and don't get discouraged. During Coleman's afternoon shift, passing cars honk in support every few minutes. He might get 1 out of 10 cars to honk, and a few will wave, but every so often, somebody will give him a thumbs down or the middle finger. While the vast majority of reactions have been positive, one detractor sticks out in his memory. Coleman says, I think it was late August. We had a young guy come down on a bicycle. We thought he was going to come over and talk to us about it. He proceeded to just smash that sign apart. It was in pieces. And he didn't say a word till he was all done, and he said, there you go. And he got on his bicycle and took off. But Coleman focuses on the positive interactions. He says, there was a young woman here, and she said, I've been seeing you for months, and it affected me deeply, he says, and she started to cry. So, I think we're getting those three-second connections with people. It's kind of a micro-community, I guess. Next, from Brittany McGee, Christmas Miracle, this article published in partnership with the UNC Media Hub. From the sidewalk, Charlotte Unruh sees exactly what she wants. Past the picket fence and the colorful wooden rocking chairs, the vibrant knickknacks, and the chalkboard advertising custom farm tables, the two-year-old spies a small, lighted tree with a cherry red sleigh through the front window. Christmas! Christmas! Charlotte shouts as she jumps up and down, begging to go inside. When Charlotte and her parents, Amy and Alan, enter the small country store in Apex, they're quickly taken in by the sweet scent from the candles and candy, the creaking hardwood floors, and the mishmash of home decor items. The rusty bucket feels more like a home than a store. The owners, Pam and Mac Thorpe, greet the young family and begin doting on Charlotte, who shies away. Mac, having recently welcomed his 11th grandchild, knows what to do. Guiding the little girl up the wooden ramp that leads to the back half of the store, he lets her pick out something from the candy section. What do you say? Amy asks Charlotte. She thanks him, in between licks of her lollipop. The Thorpes treat their customers like family, and when the pandemic forced them to close the store for 80 days, they missed them. They missed their business, too. The pandemic strained their finances. Right now, the Thorpes need a big holiday season for the shop to survive. They need to double their revenue to make it to next year. The shopkeepers opened the rusty bucket 17 years ago. Pam had always dreamed of owning a little country store, and after she and Mac left the corporate world behind, they decided this would be their retirement plan. When the pandemic began, Pam thought the store would be closed for a week, maybe two. There were things she could be doing, getting caught up on this or that, but it didn't end. Rent was due. Insurance was due. On the days when she began to panic, Pam would remind herself that she couldn't control the pandemic. She said, I had just decided that what happens, happens. The Thorpes aren't alone in facing financial straits, of course. According to data from the U.S. Department of Commerce, real retail sales are expected to decline more than $500 billion from 2019 to 2020. Foot traffic was down by more than 62%, according to Retail Next. Reviving the foot traffic and bringing people out to fill the historic district's streets is something the town of Apex has been focused on. The Thorpes are members of the Apex Downtown Business Association, which gelled during the Great Recession. Now its members have come together again for the pandemic. What were once monthly meetings are now weekly. They've also been able to work with the town's small business coordinator to communicate their ideas and concerns. For Pam and Mac, looking out for their two employees and ensuring they continued to be paid has been the hardest part of the year. Debbie Jackson has worked for the Rusty Bucket for 15 years. They're not her bosses, they're her friends, she says. Pam and Debbie have bonded over their taste in home decor. Jackson says, my house looks just like this, as she waves her hand at the rusty aesthetic in the store. Mine and Pam's. COVID-19 is scary for Jackson because she is both a senior citizen and a lung cancer survivor. She lives on Social Security, and her part-time job, so the period that the store was closed was concerning. Pam and Mac still managed to pay their employees during that time, fulfilling a promise they'd made to themselves. However, this couldn't completely alleviate Jackson's financial concerns. Chemotherapy didn't completely kill her cancer. She's lucky there is medication she can take to control it, but it's expensive. At one point, her medication was about $13,000 a month. She's grateful that Medicare and the state pay the majority of the cost, but she's still responsible for the copay. During the 80-day period the store was closed, the Thorpes partially relied on revenue from the custom farm tables that Mac builds. After helping customers choose a style and guiding them on getting the measurements, he places them on the build list. It's a 6-month wait. When Mac recently delivered a formal dining room table, the customer's husband called her downstairs to see the table in the room for the first time. She stood on the platform of the stairway and began crying. Mac says, "The joy of seeing that lady's tears is a reward that money can't buy." Despite these small victories, the store owners agree they desperately need money from the stimulus package that's languished in Congress, or the real risk their businesses will not survive. The Rusty Bucket usually thrives this time of year. Mac is a professional Santa Claus, so the store tends to be a big hit. One recent Friday night, a couple with a 4-year-old boy ventured inside the store. He wandered around, taking everything in before stopping at the bottom of the ramp, connecting the front and back of the store. "Oh," the boy exclaimed loudly, "this is the store where Santa was." From behind the counter, Mac leaned forward and pulled his face mask down so his long white beard was visible. "And how do you know he's not here now?" Mac asked. The boy ran to his parents, terrified, before going to sit down to tell Santa what he wanted for Christmas. For Pam and Mac, these interactions could be their Christmas miracle. Everything else is out of their hands. Now, our next article is one of the longest articles I've ever seen in the Indie Week. It goes on for several pages, and it's written by Paul Rosenberg. And it's the cover story on the Indie Week for this week. Project Censored. Media Blackout. Top 10 stories of the year show patterns in corporate news. Every year since 1976, Project Censored has performed an invaluable service, shedding light on the most significant news that's somehow not fit to print. Censorship in an authoritarian society is obvious, from a distance at least. There's a central agent or agency responsible for it, and the lines are clearly drawn. That's not the case in America, yet some stories rarely, if ever, see the light of day, such as stories about violence against Native American women and girls, even though 4 out of 5 of them experience violence at some point in their lives, overwhelmingly at the hands of non-Native perpetrators. Anita Lucchesi, a Southern Cheyenne descendant and executive director of the Sovereign Bodies Institute, told The Guardian, "I wouldn't say that we're more vulnerable. I'd say that we're targeted. It's not about us being vulnerable victims. It's about the system being designed to target and marginalize our women." And the media erasure of their stories is part of that same system of targeting and marginalization. While journalists work hard to expose injustices every day, they work within a system where some injustices are so deeply baked in that stories exposing them are rarely told, and even more rarely expanded upon to give them their proper due. That's where Project Censored comes in. As its founder, Carl Jensen, wrote on the organization's 20th anniversary, "The primary purpose of Project Censored is to explore and publicize the extent of news censorship in our society by locating stories about significant issues of which the public should be aware, but is not, for a variety of reasons." Thus, the list of censored stories that's the centerpiece of its annual book, State of the Free Press 2021, doesn't just help us to see individual stories we might otherwise have missed. It helps us see patterns, patterns of censorship, of stories suppressed, and patterns of how those stories fit together. This year, for example, among its top 10 stories, there are two stories about the violence and victimization of women of color, including the role of media neglect. Three stories concerning the media itself, two climate change stories about overlooked causes and risks, and two related to income inequality. There are also further climate change threads woven through these stories, a highlighted connection between the extractive fossil fuel industry and violence against Native women, as well as an unmentioned connection via agrochemical and agricultural biotechnology company Monsanto's employment of business advisory firm FTI Consulting, which has been heavily involved in climate disinformation warfare. The stories listed below are only part of what Project Censored does, however. State of the Pre-Press 2021 has chapters devoted to other forms of obfuscation that help keep censored stories obscured. There's a chapter devoted to junk food news, meaning cheaply produced stories focused on celebrityhood, industry-generated buzz, and other trivia in place of substantive investigative journalism, and another devoted to news abuse, meaning genuinely important topics presented through a distorted lens or two. There's also a chapter devoted to deja vu news, tracking previous Project Censored stories to update them and track whether they've gained some of the wider attention they deserve. And Media Democracy in Action highlights individuals and organizations engaged in building a more inclusive, equitable, and democratic society. So, if the top 10 stories summarized below leave you hungry for more, Project Censored has all that and more waiting for you in State of the Free Press 2021. Number 1, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. Project Censored notes, in June 2019, the Canadian National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls released its final report, which received widespread news coverage in the United States. Yet, U.S. corporate news outlets have provided nearly nothing in the way of reporting on missing and murdered Indigenous women in the United States. That's despite a problem of similar dimensions and complexity facing Indigenous communities here, along with the election of the first two Native American Congresswomen, Deb Holland and Cherise Davids. The latter, Ms. Magazine reported, are supporting two bills that would address the federal government's failure to track and respond to violence against Indigenous women, and, quote, are supported by a mass movement in the United States and Canada, raising an alarm about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Four in the five Native women experience violence at some time in their lives, according to a 2016 survey by the National Institute of Justice, cited in a August 2019 Think Progress report. And, quote, 9 in 10 Native Americans rape or sexually assault victims had assailants who were white or black, according to a 1999 Justice Department report. And Think Progress noted, although the number of Native Americans murdered or missing in 2016 exceeded 3,000, roughly the number of people who died during September 11th terror attack, the Justice Department's missing persons database logged only 116 cases that year. The sheer scale of the violence against Native women and the abysmal failure by the government to adequately address it explains why the issue was given such prominence during the week's presidential candidates forum in Sioux City, Iowa, the first to focus entirely on Native American issues. But even that didn't grab media attention. There are multiple complicating factors in reporting, tracking, investigating, and prosecuting that were explored in coverage by The Guardian and Yes Magazine, as well as Ms. and Think Progress. Project Censored sums up, quote, campaigners, including the Sovereign Bodies Institute, the Brave Heart Society, and the Urban Indian Health Institute, identify aspects of systemic racism, including the indelible legacies of settler colonialism, issues with law enforcement, a lack of reliable and comprehensive data, and flawed policymaking as deep-rooted sources of the crisis. As Yes Magazine reported, tribal communities in the United States often lack a jurisdiction to respond to crimes, Project Censored notes. This was partially remedied, in the 2013 reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. But it, quote, left sex trafficking and other forms of sexual violence outside tribal jurisdiction, Yes Magazine reported. The House voted to expand tribal jurisdiction in such cases in its 2019 VAWA reauthorization, but as Ms. pointed out, the bill is now languishing in the Senate, where Republicans have so far blocked a vote. Another facet of the problem explored by ES is the connection between the extractive fossil fuel industry and violence against Native women. The Canadian report, ES noted, showed a strong link between extraction zones on the missing and murdered women crisis in Canada. It specifically cited rotational shift work, sexual harassment in the workplace, substance abuse, economic insecurity, and a largely transient workforce as contributing to increased violence against Native women in communities near fossil fuel infrastructure. Sovereign Bodies Institute says, it creates this culture of using and abuse. If you can use and abuse the water and land, you can use and abuse the people around you, too. Project Censored concludes, as a result of limited news coverage, the United States is far from a national reckoning on its crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Article number 2, Monsanto Intelligence Center targeted journalists and activists. In its fight to avoid liability for causing cancer, the agricultural giant Monsanto, now owned by Bayer, created a intelligence fusion center to monitor and discredit journalists and activists, Sam Levin reported for The Guardian in August of 2019. Quote, more than 18,000 people have filed suit against Monsanto, alleging that exposure to Roundup weed killer caused non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and that Monsanto covered up the risks by manipulating scientific data and silencing critics, The Hill summarized. The company has lost three high-profile cases in the past year, and Bayer is reportedly offering $8 billion to settle all outstanding claims. And a Reuters journalist, Kerry Gilliam, reported, Monsanto adopted a multi-pronged strategy to target Kerry Gilliam, the Reuters journalist who investigated, while also targeting rock musician Neil Young, who released a 2015 record, The Monsanto Years, and creating a massive multi-million dollar spying and disinformation campaign targeting journalists, scientists, and advocates exposing the risk of its product posed, creating a covert army of seemingly neutral allies to attack its critics was central to Monsanto's strategy, according to the paper. Now, The Guardian's report was based on internal documents, primarily from 2015 to 2017, released during trial. They showed that, quote, Monsanto planned a series of actions to attack a book authored by Gilliam prior to its release, including writing talking points for third parties to criticize the book and directing industry and farmer customers on how to post negative reviews. In addition, Monsanto paid Google to skew search results, promoting criticism of Gilliam's work on Monsanto, and it discussed strategies for pressuring Reuters with the goal of getting her reassigned. The company had a Kerry Gilliam book spreadsheet with more than 20 actions dedicated to, quote, opposing her book before its publication. It also wrote a lengthy report about singer Neil Young's anti-Monsanto advocacy, monitoring his impact on social media, and at one point considering legal action. The entire pool of journalists covering the third trial was also targeted in a covert influence operation, Paul Thacker reported for HuffPost. A purported freelancer for the BBC schmoozed other reporters, trying to steer them toward writing stories critical of the plaintiffs suing Monsanto. Their curiosity aroused, they discovered that her LinkedIn account said she worked for FTI Consulting, a global business advisory firm that Monsanto and Bayer, Monsanto's parent company, had engaged for consulting. And she subsequently pulled a digital disappearing act. FTI staff have previously attempted to obtain information under the guise of journalism, Packer added. In January, two FTI consultants working for Western Wire, a, quote, news and analysis website, backed by the oil and gas trade group Western Energy Alliance, attempted to question an attorney who represents communities suing Exxon over climate change. Nor was FTI alone. Thacker wrote, Monsanto has also previously employed shadowy networks of consultants, PR firms, and front groups to try to spy on and influence reporters. And all of it appears to be part of a pattern at the company of using a variety of tactics to intimidate, mislead, and discredit journalists and critics. As The Guardian noted, quote, Monsanto officials were repeatedly worried about the release of documents on their financial relationships with scientists that could support the allegations they were covering up unflattering research, while at the same time it had tried to attract critics as anti-science. And it summed up, the internal communications add fuel to the ongoing claims in court that Monsanto has bullied critics and scientists, and worked to conceal the dangers of glyphosate, the world's most widely used herbicide. Monsanto's campaign to monitor and discredit journalists and other critics has received almost no corporate news coverage, Project Censored notes. A rare exception was a June 2019 ABC News report that nonetheless consistently emphasized the perspective of Monsanto and Bayer. Number three, the U.S. military, a massive hidden contributor to climate crisis. As the saying goes, an army travels on its stomach. But even the U.S. Army has admitted that fuel is the blood of the military, as quoted in Hidden Carbon Costs of the Everywhere War, a study by Oliver Belcher, Patrick Bigger, Ben Niemark, and Cara Canelli, who summarized their findings for The Conversation in June of 2019. The U.S. military is, quote, one of the largest polluters in history, consuming more liquid fuels and emitting more climate-changing gases than most medium-sized countries, they wrote. If it were a country, it would rank as the 47th largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. Studies of greenhouse gas emissions usually focus on civilian use, but the U.S. military has a larger carbon footprint than any civilian corporation in the world. The U.S. military's climate policy remains fundamentally contradictory, the study notes. On one hand, the military sees climate change as a threat multiplier, or a condition that will exacerbate other threats, and is fast becoming one of the leading federal agencies in the United States to invest in research and adoption of renewable energy. On the other hand, it remains the largest single institutional consumer of hydrocarbons in the world. This dependence on fossil fuels, the paper says, is unlikely to change as the USA continues to pursue open-ended operations around the globe. While the military has invested in developing biofuels, the authors say, the entire point of these fuels is that they are drop-in. They can be used in existing military kit, which means that whenever convenient or cheaper, the infrastructure is already in place to undo whatever marginal gains have been made in decarbonization. Things will only get worse. The study notes, there is no shortage of evidence that the climate is on the brink of irreversible tipping points. Once past those tipping points, the impacts of climate change will continue to be more intense, prolonged, and widespread. giving cover to even more extensive U.S. military interventions. According to the authors, understanding the military's climate impact requires a systems approach. They quote, "We argue that to account for the U.S. military as a major climate actor, one must understand the logistical supply chain that makes its acquisition and consumption of hydrocarbon-based fuels possible. We show several path dependencies, war-fighting paradigms, weapon systems, bureaucratic requirements, and waste that are put in place by military supply chains and undergird a heavy reliance on carbon-based fuels by the U.S. military for years to come." As Project Censored explains, data for their study was difficult to obtain. Quote, "A loophole in the 1997 Kyoto Protocol exempted the United States from reporting military emissions. Although the Paris Accord closed this loophole, Niemark, Belcher, and Bigger noted that with the Trump administration due to withdraw from this accord in 2020, this gap will return. They only obtained fuel purchase data through multiple Freedom of Information Act requests." Finally, Project Censored says, "Noting that action on climate change demands shuttering vast sections of the military machine, the authors recommended that money spent procuring and distributing fuel across the U.S. empire be reinvested as a peace dividend, helping to fund a Green New Deal in whatever form it may take." Not surprisingly, the report had received little to no corporate news coverage as of May of 2020, behind scattered republication of the piece in Conversation. Number four, congressional investments and conflicts of interest. Exposition, political corruption, and conflicts of interest are age-old staples of journalism, so it's notable that corporate media has virtually ignored two of the most glaring congressional conflicts of interest in the Trump era: Republican support for the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and bipartisan failure to act on climate change. Peter Carey of the Center for Public Integrity reported for Vox in January of 2020, "The cuts likely saved members of Congress hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes collectively, while the corporate tax cuts hiked the value of their holdings. It was sold as a middle-class tax cut that would benefit everyone, but according to Carey, promises that the Tax Act would boost investment have not panned out. Corporate investment is now at lower levels than before the act passed, according to the Commerce Department. Once again, trickle-down tax cuts didn't trickle down. The tax loss centerpiece," Carey wrote, "is its record cut in the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. At the time of its passage, most of the bill's Republican supporters said the cut would result in higher wages, factory expansions, and more jobs. Instead, it was mainly exploited by corporations, which bought back stock and raised dividends. Buybacks exceeded $1 trillion for the first time ever the year after the cuts were passed, according to investment research firm TrimTabs, and dividends topped a record $1.3 billion high. The benefits to congressional Republicans were enormous. The 10 richest Republicans in Congress in 2017 who voted for the tax bill held more than $731 million in assets, almost two-thirds of which were stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and other instruments," Carey wrote, noting that, quote, "all but one of the 47 Republicans who sat on the three key committees overseeing the drafting of the tax bill owned stocks and stock mutual funds, and they stood to benefit handsomely from legislation that doled out nearly $150 billion in corporate tax savings in 2018 alone. Of course, Democrats also stood to gain from the tax bill, although not one voted for it. All but 12 Republicans voted for the tax bill. Two special features deserve notice. First is a newly created 20% deduction for income from pass-through businesses, or smaller single-owner corporations. At least 22 of the 47 members of the House and Senate tax writing committees have investments in pass-through businesses," Project Censored notes. Second, was a provision allowing real estate companies with relatively few employees, like the Trump Organization, to take a 20% deduction usually reserved for larger businesses with sizable payrolls. Project Censored points out, out of the 47 Republicans responsible for drafting the bill, at least 29 held real estate interests at the time of its passage. As to the second major conflict, members of the U.S. Senate are heavily invested in the fossil fuel companies that drive the current climate crisis, creating a conflict between those senators' financial interests as investors and their responsibilities as elected representatives. Donald Shaw reported for Sludge in 2019, September, 29 U.S. senators and their spouses owned between $3.5 and $13.9 million worth of stock in companies that extract, transport, or burn fossil fuels or provide services to fossil fuel companies. While unsurprising on the Republican side, this also includes two key Democrats. Senator Tom Carper, Democrat of Delaware, is the top Democrat on the Committee of Environment and Public Works, and he has up to $310,000 invested in more than a dozen oil, gas, and utility companies, as well as mutual funds with holdings in the fossil fuel industry, Shaw reported. But his record is not nearly as questionable as Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, the ranking member of the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, who, quote, owns between $1 and $5 million worth of non-public stock in a family coal business, Inner Systems, and reported earning between $100,000 and $1 million in dividends and interest in 2018, plus $470,000 in ordinary business income, according to Shaw. His support for the industry was significant, as Shaw spelled out, quote, Manchin was the only Democrat to vote against an amendment to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge from oil drilling in 2017, and he was one of just three Democrats to vote against an amendment to phase out taxpayer subsidies for coal, oil, and gas producers in 2016. Manchin has also voted to approve construction of the Keystone XL oil pipeline, expedite the approval process for natural gas pipelines, and override an Obama administration rule requiring coal companies to protect groundwater from toxic coal mining waste. While there has been critical coverage of those 2017 tax cuts, this has not included coverage of lawmakers personally profiting, Project Censored notes. In addition, despite the significant conflicts of interest exposed in Donald Shaw's reporting for Sludge, the alarming facts about U.S. senators' massive investment in the fossil fuel industry appears to have gone completely unreported in the corporate press. Number 5. Inequality kills. The gap between richest and poorest Americans, the largest in 50 years. DePaul University sociologist Fernando de Mayo wrote for Truth Out in December 2019, in public health, decades of research are coming to a consensus, inequality kills. Even before COVID-19, de Mayo's research added fine-grained evidence to broad trends highlighted in three governmental reports. The gap between rich and poor Americans has grown larger than ever in half a century, according to the Census Bureau's 2019 annual survey. And there is dramatic evidence of that development's lethal impact. People in the poorest quintile die at twice the rate as those in the richest, according to a report by the U.S. Government Accountability Office. This is partly because job-related deaths are increasingly rooted in the physical and psychological toll of low-wage work, as opposed to on-the-job accidents, as documented by the United Nations International Labor Organizations. All these conditions were made worse by COVID-19, but they could have been seen before the pandemic struck if only the information hadn't been censored by the corporate media. As Project Censored notes, quote, as of May 2020, Project Censored had not been able to identify any corporate news coverage on the GAO or Census Bureau reports on inequality and premature mortality, or on the International Labor Organization report about work-related illness, accident, and deaths that take place when workers are off duty. The August 2019 GAO report was based on health and retirement surveys conducted by the Social Security Administration in 1992 and 2014, looking at those between 51 and 61 years old in 1992, and dividing them into five wealth quintiles. Patrick Martin, writing for the World Socialist website, explained that the GAO found that nearly half of those, 48%, in the poorest quintile died before 2014, when they would have been between 73 and 83 years old. Of the wealthiest quintile, only a quarter, 26%, died. Death rates increased for each quintile as the level of wealth declined. It's at the level of cities and communities that the most striking links between inequality and health can be detected, DeMeo wrote. At the city level, life expectancy varies from a low of 71.4 years in Gary, Indiana, to a high of 84.7 in Newton, Massachusetts. That's a gap of more than 13 years. At the community level, in Chicago, there is a 9-year gap between the life expectancy for black and white people. This gap amounts to more than 3,000 excess deaths among black Chicagoans due to heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, and kidney disease. All of these are conditions that an equitable health care system would address, he concluded. And Project Censors note, the poorest Americans are also more likely than their rich counterparts to face illness or premature death due to the inherent dangers of low-wage work. Maria Jose Carmona wrote for Inequality.org, in 2019, you no longer have to hang from scaffolding to risk your life on the job. Precariousness, stress, and overwork can also make you sick and even kill you at a much higher rate than accidents. Carmona reported on an ILO report that found that less than 14% of the 7,500 people who die due to unsafe and healthy working conditions every day die from workplace accidents. The greatest risk comes from increasing pressure, precarious contracts, and working hours incompatible with life, which bit by bit continue to feed the invisible accident rate that does not appear in the news. The most vulnerable workers are those employed on a temporary or casual basis, those subcontracted through agencies, and the false self-employed. ILO data shows the rate of accidents for these employees to be much higher than for any others. As of May 2020, Project Censored has not been able to identify any corporate news coverage on the GAO or Census Bureau reports on inequality and premature mortality, or on the ILO report about work-related illness, accidents, and deaths that take place when workers are off duty. Number 6, shadow network of conservative outlets emerges to exploit faith in local news. Carol Thompson in the Lansing State Journal in 2019 observed, dozens of websites branded as local news outlets launched throughout Michigan this fall, promising local news but also offering political messaging. The website's About Us sections say they are published by Metric Media LLC, a company that aims to fill the, quote, growing void in local and community news after years of steady disinvestment in local reporting by legacy media, Thompson wrote. But it soon emerged that they weren't filling that void with locally generated news, and the 40 or so sites Thompson found in Michigan were just the tip of the iceberg. A follow-up investigation by the Michigan Daily reported, quote, just this past week, additional statewide networks of these websites have sprung up in Montana and Iowa, which is followed by a December 2019 report by the Columbia Journalism Review revealing a network of 450 websites run by five corporate organizations in 12 states that, quote, mimic the appearance and output of traditional news organizations in order to manipulate public opinion by exploiting faith in local media. All were associated with conservative businessman Brian Timpone. CJR's Paranja Bengani reported, In 2012, Timpona's company, Journatic, an outlet known for low-cost automated storage generation, which has become known as pink slime journalism, attracted national attention and outrage for faking bylines and quotes and for plagiarism. Journatic was later rebranded as Locality Labs, whose content ran on the Metric Media websites. Michigan Daily reported, the different websites are nearly indistinguishable, sharing identical stories and using regional titles. The only author articles with named authors contain politically skewed content. The rest of the articles on the sites are primarily composed of press releases from local organizations and articles written by the local Labs News Service. Despite the different organization and network names, it's evident these sites are connected, Bengani wrote. Other than simply sharing network metadata, as described above, they also share bylines, including Metric Media News Service and Local Labs News Service, for templated stories, servers, layouts, and templates. Using a suite of investigative tools, CJR was able to identify at least 189 sites in 10 states run by Metric Media, all created in 2019, along with 179 run by Franklin Archer, with Timpone's brother, Michael, as CEO. Begani wrote, we tapped into the RSS feeds of these 189 Metric Media sites and found over 15,000 unique stories had been published, over 50,000 when aggregated across the sites, but only about 100 titles had the bylines of human reporters. That's well below 1% with a byline, much less being local. The rest cited automated services or press releases. He explained, their architecture and strategy is useful to understand the way they co-opt the language, design, and structure of news organizations. Automation can make them seem far more prolific than they really are and can help build credibility. Quote, potentially adding to the credibility is their Google search ranking. In the cases of some of the websites set up in 2015-16, we observed that once sites had gained ample authority, they appeared on the first page of Google search results, just below the official government and social media pages. So, the sites aim to fool people locally about the source of their news, and Google helps fool the world. Although the New York Times did publish an article on October 2019 that credited Lansing State Journal with breaking the story about pseudo-local news organization, Project Censors noted that corporate coverage has been lacking. The Columbia Journalism Review's piece expands on the breadth and scope of previous coverage, but its findings do not appear to have been reported by any of the major establishment news outlets. Number 7, underreporting of missing and victimized black women and girls. They go missing in the U.S. at a higher rate than that of their white counterparts, and that very fact goes missing too. This is Karma Henry reporting for the Westside Gazette in February 2019. A 2010 study about the media coverage of missing children in the U.S. discovered that only 20% of reported stories focused on missing black children, despite it corresponding to 33% of the overall missing children cases. But it's only getting worse. A 2015 study discussed in the William and Mary Journal of Race, Gender, and Social Justice found that the disparity listed in the 2010 study between reportage and reality had increased substantially. Project Censored notes, 35% of missing children cases versus just 7% of media stories. That discussion appeared in a paper that made two other pertinent points. First, that black criminal perpetrators are overrepresented in the media, while black victims are underrepresented. And second, that, quote, because racial minorities are identified as criminals more often than not, non-minorities develop limited empathy toward racial minorities who are often perceived as offenders. Non-minorities in the media are obviously not exempt. Project Censored notes, media coverage is often vital in missing person cases because it raises community awareness and can drive funding and search efforts that support finding those missing persons. And it goes on to cite an illustrative extreme case. In October 2019, the Atlanta Black Star shed light on perhaps the most prolific offender against black women and girls in recent history, Jason Roger Pope, who has been indicted on charges relating to human trafficking and child sex crimes. Project Censored writes, Pope, a white South Carolina promoter and popular disc jockey, better known as DJ Kid, has made claims suggesting that he may have participated in trafficking, assault, and/or rapes of nearly 700 African-American girls, primarily underage, right up until his arrest in 2019. The arrest didn't come out of the blue. Pope has police records going as far back as 2011 relating to sexual misconduct with minors, yet outside of a few local news outlets, the corporate media has been silent on Pope's crimes. Black people are also overrepresented as victims of sex trafficking. According to statistics from Human Trafficking Search, they account for more than 40% of confirmed victims compared to 13% of the population. While there is some coverage from small independent sources, this gap in coverage of missing black women and girls has gone widely underreported. Project Censored cited two exceptions, one from ABC News, another from CNN. But broadly, they say, U.S. corporate media are not willing to discuss their own shortcomings or to acknowledge the responsibilities they neglect by failing to provide coverage on the searching for missing and victimized black women and girls. Number 8, the public banking revolution. The year 2019 marked the 100th anniversary of the U.S. first publicly owned state bank, the Bank of North Dakota, BND. And in October, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed the Public Banking Act, authorizing up to 10 similar such banks to be created by California's city and county governments. In response, the cities of San Francisco and Los Angeles both announced plans to do so. It was the culmination of a decade-long effort that began in the wake of the Great Recession that's also been taken up in nearly two dozen other states. Beyond the benefits North Carolina has reaped in the past, such banks could have greatly assisted in responding to COVID-19's economic devastation and could yet help fund a just transition to a decarbonized future along the lines of a Green New Deal. Yet despite California's agenda-setting reputation, Project Censored notes, quote, no major corporate media outlets appear to have devoted recent coverage to this important and timely topic. Ellen Brown, former of the Public Banking Institute, wrote for Common Dreams, the Bank of North Dakota was founded in 1919 in response to a farmer's revolt against out-of-state banks that were foreclosing unfairly on their farms. Since then, it has evolved into a $7.4 billion bank that is reported to be even more profitable than J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, although its mandate is not actually to make a profit, but simply to serve the interests of local North Dakota communities. Sushil Jacob, an attorney who works for the California Public Banking Alliance, told The Guardian, the state of North Dakota has six times as many financial institutions per capita as the rest of the country, and it's because they have the Bank of North Dakota. When the Great Recession hit, the Bank of North Dakota stepped in and provided loans and allowed local banks to thrive. As a result, Brown told Anaya Garg, reporting for Yes Magazine, North Dakota was the only state that escaped the credit crisis. It never went in the red, had the lowest unemployment rate in the country, and the lowest foreclosure rate at that time. Eric Heath wrote in an op-ed for The Hill, there are two ways in which a state bank can fund state investment for a greener future. First, the bank can provide loans, bonds, and other forms of financing for investments to the state government and private organizations on better terms than those available in regular markets. Some such projects might not even be considered. This is not because green investments are unprofitable, but because their profits slowly accumulate and are widely shared across a community, Heath explained, and went on. Second, a public bank will improve a state's fiscal health. By holding state deposits as assets, the bank's profits can be returned to state coffers to fund direct state investment. Additionally, the activity of the state bank, which will prioritize investing state assets and extending credit within the state for the benefit of the state, will improve the state economy, just as it happened in North Dakota. A new surge of interest in public banking came out of the Standing Rock Movement's Dakota Access Pipeline protests. While individuals could easily withdraw from doing business with fossil fuel financing banks, Wells Fargo in this case, governments have no such similar options to meet all their banking needs. In short, Project Censored writes, from efforts to divest public employee pension funds from the fossil fuel industry and private prisons to funding the proposed Green New Deal and counteracting the massive rapid shutdown of the economy caused by the pandemic, public banking has never seemed more relevant. It's a time-tested practical solution the corporate media refuses to address. And there are two further articles that I have run out of time to read. One was about the rising risks of nuclear power due to climate change. And number 10, revive journalism with stimulus package and a public option. And I do not have time even to get to the two other articles. One is a screen review of a movie called Nomadland in theaters December 4th, and it's given 4 stars, called A Road Trip Through Late-Stage Capitalism and the Sunset of the American Dream. And the last is a show, Virtually Impossible, on stage, which is also online. Durham magician Joshua Lozoff brings the magic of the stage to the small screen. And our musicians have marched back into their studio and are marching about. And it just leaves me time to say that this is John Feddersen reporting for the North Carolina Reading Service, ncreadingservice.org, where this article from the Indie Week this week can be seen in our podcast section. And I hope that you'll all be back next week. So long for now, folks.